Welcome to Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com. Joined by Lance Meadow, I am John Schmelk. Talking Giants and NFL football with you for the next 60 minutes. Getting ready for the 2017 NFL Draft. A very busy show coming your way today. We'll be joined by Mark Snyder from the Detroit Free Press in about 3 or 4 minutes. And we'll go through Michigan prospects. The last time we talked to Mark was actually, believe it or not, back in 2015 when Taylor Lewan came out in the draft. So it's been kind of quiet for Michigan prospects the last couple of years. Not a whole lot going on, but laundry list this year. God. So we'll have a lot to talk about with Mark, Mr. Meadow. And after we have Mark, we'll, of course, take your calls at 201-939-4513 and monitor your tweets at hashtag GiantsChat. Lance, how's everything?
Everything's good. How's things with you? How's the arm?
Hands, getting better. 2 weeks in. I got 4 weeks to go. Got the stitches out today.
Well, that's a positive development.
Which is a nice step in the right direction. Good therapy twice a week. We're moving along. But it appears that I would have a better chance playing football this year at this point than Tony Romo.
Yeah, because, so look at that transition. Boy,
it was weak.
You were digging deep
for
that one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But he announced, well, not he did not announce it, but Adam Schefter reporting that Tony Romo was going to retire after the Cowboys release him today. The Cowboys have not announced anything yet. And then he will go work for CBS. Early indications are, and I frankly find this hard to believe, that he's going to be immediately put into their first broadcast team with Jim Nantz, and I don't know what that means for Phil Sims, which is surprising to me because usually you try to work these guys in slowly, like Fox did with John Lynch. They kind of moved him slowly up the depth chart there.
Or put him in the studio before they get comfortable.
Something like that, but that's the word. So it looks like Tony Romo is going to retire. You wonder if he's going to have a clause in that TV contract where if Dak Prescott tears up an ankle in week six and the Cowboys come calling, if he's going to come back and play, that wouldn't shock me. But it looks like this whole saga, thank goodness, I was tired of hearing about it, is coming to an end.
Yeah, well, ProFootballTalk.com is actually reporting that he probably is going to have a clause in the contract to
enable him. Okay.
That's what Mike Florio is reporting. And I would think that this may change the Cowboys' game plan to keep him and have him on the reserve retired list like Marshawn Lynch with Seattle, so that this way you still have his rights if he does determine that he wants to come back.
That's a good question. But if they do that, then they will not be able to save his salary cap space for this year and save that money, which they would get if they would release him. So,
well, it does have some finances.
Well, you know, if he's on a retired list, I don't know how that would work.
I don't know. I don't know if that's 100% about whether or not they wouldn't have some flexibility.
I don't know how that would work, to be honest with
you.
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I'd have to check on that.
But with that being said, remember, they've been operating all this time since free agency started with him on the books to begin with.
Correct.
So, you know, clearly, I think that the way that Dak Prescott's contract is structured, since he's still on a rookie deal, afforded them the luxury to hold on to Romo. That's why I'd be surprised if this changes the dynamics of their relationship with Romo, given the fact that, at least right now, it appears he's going to be retired.
Yeah, I got to imagine if he retires, they would owe him his bonus guaranteed money, which is what's still, you know, the quote-unquote dead money on his contract.
Which had been spread out based
right,
on the restructuring.
Right, but I imagine
so
the base salary would disappear the same way he would if he was released and let go. I would think.
I think that that's perhaps how it works. I don't know off the top of my head.
It's a good question.
I mean, it would make sense that it goes elsewhere to enable you to have some flexibility considering a player is inactive and retired at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. So what does this mean for the NFC East? Quite frankly, not a whole lot. I don't think a lot of people figured that Romo would be a big factor this year in the division anyway, given Dak Prescott's won the job and played extremely well last year. So it's just something we don't have to hear about on NFL This Morning. We don't have to hear about it on
Well, you're still going to be hearing about it for the next few days. I guarantee you that.
Well, yeah, only for a couple days, though, and then we'll, of course, see Romo on CBS next year. How do you think he'll do? He's very well spoken.
He is.
He generally doesn't have a, like, when he does interviews, you don't get a sense of, like, ton of energy from him and stuff like that. How do you think he'll do?
Well, I think in terms of the knowledge of the game, he's up there. So, I mean, if they want him to break it down and be an X's and O's type of guy, I think he fits that bill. In terms of personality and energy, I'll give you that, that maybe that remains to be seen. But, you know, keep in mind, just from perusing some of the stories, he's had a big presence on social media during his off days here where he hasn't been active on the football field, and he's actually posted some funny videos. So I think this would actually give him the opportunity to show a different side of his personality that we haven't yet seen when you're an NFL player. Remember, when you don't want to bring attention to yourself and you're the quarterback of the Cowboys, sometimes you have that personality where you don't want to
be the story.
Correct. I mean, to a certain degree, Eli Manning is like that too. I think he plays to the New York media perfectly. He doesn't give them plenty of substance to run with because he knows how to play the game. But if you take Eli Manning off of the football field, you see he does have that comic side as well.
Absolutely. All right, thanks for joining us on Twitter, everybody. If you want to watch the rest of the show, go to Giants.com or the Giants mobile app. And in just a few moments, we'll be joined by Mark Snyder from the Detroit Free Press. So make sure you check that out. And now we do welcome in our guest. He's Mark Snyder from the Detroit Free Press. He joins us on Giants.com to talk about some of the prospects coming out of Michigan. Mark, you got John Schmelk and Lance Meadow here in East Rutherford, New Jersey. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
We're doing great. And, you know, it's been a couple years since we spoke, back when Taylor Lewan was coming out of the draft. It's been a quiet few years for Michigan prospects. But, boy, do we have a laundry list for you today. So if we keep you too long, Mark, I want you to tell us, and we'll say goodbye, because this might go a little bit longer than you expect, given all these players coming out of Michigan this year. So I will pre-warn you. Let's start with the guy that I suppose is the most polarizing player in the draft in a lot of ways, and that's Jabril Peppers. No one doubts his athleticism. People do doubt where he fits in on an NFL football field. What's your take in terms of where you think he will be most effective as a pro?
Jabril says he's a safety, and I think he's right. I think that that's just the nature of his talents and kind of what he can do. I know a lot of people have questioned the coverage skills, and that's something that's fair. I think that's a fair criticism, and I don't think some of that's because he just wasn't in coverage that often. You didn't see him in coverage. You didn't see him. I mean, he has elite speed. You know, in high school, which is just, what, four years ago, he was running, you know, 10 500s, and he was state champion in track. So he can run with guys. Mm-hmm. But, you know, obviously, when you're in coverage, that's a situation where you need experience. You need to practice doing that every day. You need to know the techniques. And he was just doing a lot of it on athleticism. So in terms of that, I think that he can learn to do anything in terms of the coverage skills and if he's exclusively at one position. But since he's been at Michigan, he's been all over. You know, the first year they had him at cornerback and he got hurt after the first couple games. The second year they had him at safety, but they started moving him around the field. And last year, obviously, he played 15 positions and 933 snaps at all these different spots. I mean, how do you end up knowing anything well? You saw in the first half of the year when you watched last year, you know, what he led the nation for the first, I think, four or five games in tackles for loss. He's 205 pounds. I mean, he was blitzing from a strong side linebacker spot, so he can do it. Obviously, teams adjust. They started overloading the line to protect against him coming in from wherever he was. They tried to move him around. But the idea that he can do all of those things and still be productive, I think that makes him a very attractive prospect. Just because he doesn't have a position, what does that say about NFL personnel? You know, they should be creative enough to know what they could do with him.
Yep. Yeah, he's essentially a Swiss Army knife, as you described, Mark. It's funny because he actually reminds me, and I'm not saying that he's the same player, he reminds me of Shaq Thompson out of Washington a few years ago, who's now with the Carolina Panthers. And there were similar questions, Mark, if you recall, when Shaq Thompson came out.
Yep.
Is he a linebacker? Is he a safety? What do we do with him? And so forth. And for the most part, you know, he's fit in very nicely with Carolina. You talked about the coverage skills for Peppers. And the one thing that jumped out to me is when you look at his stats, only one interception, if I'm correct, Mark. And I think there's been some questions about, even if you put him into a coverage position, does he have the hand skill set to thrive in that area? What have you seen in terms of his hand skills if at the NFL level he's got to maybe line up with receivers and tight ends?
Saw him catch punts for 2 years and he didn't drop one.
That's pretty good.
I think right there, you know, shows all you need to know about his hands. You know, I think the only interception he got was on a tip ball against Ohio State, but he was never in positions to get those. You know, I mean, they didn't have him running with receivers downfield. And when he did, and, you know, even when he was a safety, you know, he's chasing guys. He's trying to run them down for the most part. You know, it wasn't coverage because he was such a good tackler, especially last year, 2 years ago, not as much, but last year he made such strides in his tackling that you see what he can do. I mean, it's just, you know, there's an interesting drill that he put. If you go on his Instagram from last summer, he did this drill. He said he saw it somewhere in the NFL. He put his hands basically inches away from a jugs machine, and the balls, someone fired the balls in, and he caught them in his hands right there, like 6 inches away, like maybe like 10 balls in a row. You know, you got to have crazy strong hands to be able to do something like that.
Yeah, no question about it. And this is the final question for me on Peppers, Mark. And I think I know the answer to it already, but I want to confirm it, because to me, if you're a guy that your coach is confident in you to move you around as much as they did, you have to have really good football instincts. You have to be able to react well and do all that stuff. Are those at an elite level for him, which I would imagine, like you said earlier, would probably make it easier for him when he starts to focus in on one spot to get good there relatively quickly?
Well, think of it this way, okay? This is the way Harbaugh described him. He said he's only had one other player who had the football intelligence of Jabril Peppers, and that was Andrew Luck.
That's
Andrew
not
Luck
bad.
Only had to play one position, okay? Peppers played offense, defense, special teams, and what he did is he would go from meeting to meeting, learn his spot, and move on, and then he played it in the game. And you never saw him, you know, just exposed in any circumstance. So that shows how quickly – I mean, they were amazed, especially defense coordinator Don Brown, special teams coach. I had coached him in high school, so he knew what was going on. And Harbaugh, they were just amazed at how they could throw things at him. And, you know, that probably hurt him. That's hurting him now because they used him in so many spots. But it helped them in such a magnificent way because they knew that he could cover up for everyone. When he was hurt in the bowl game, you know, Michigan had the number one defense in the country. And then you saw in the bowl game, you know, Florida State was running all over them for the first, you know, three quarters or so because they had to compensate because they knew Peppers wasn't there. He filled so many holes. That was just obviously the dramatic difference, and they didn't know what to do. I mean, obviously they were putting a freshman in his place, but the idea that he filled so many spots and he could adjust not only between games but on the fly was remarkable.
Talking with Mark Snyder, who covers the University of Michigan football for the Detroit Free Press. Also on the defensive side, I think the two notable defensive ends are worth highlighting here, Mark. Taco Charlton and Chris Wormley. What is the major difference between both of them from what you've seen, and who may have a slight edge over the other based on what they bring to the table?
I think it just depends on what a team's looking for. I think Taco will probably go higher just because he's more of the traditional long, lean defensive end. You know, someone like a Clowney type, you know, who can really he's not as thick, I guess. And what he can do, he's got the really long arms, and he's got that reach. And he's able to get around guys, you know, swim moves. He's got a bunch of moves from the outside. Wormley's more of a power guy. You know, he's 310, maybe 305, 310 pounds. He played tackle at times during his career, but he's fast enough at that size to get off the edge as well. So, you know, they're not the same player by any means, but they're both, you know, they bring different things. I guess it depends on what they're looking for. You know, Wormley is more of an anchor end at Michigan, And Charlton was more a guy who just could come off the edge. The thing about Charlton, Wormley was consistently improved. The thing about Charlton, he just kind of exploded, you know, in the second half of last year. You know, for 3 years, he was just kind of there. I mean, he was solid, he was long, but he didn't use his physical gifts the same way. But you saw when he wanted to turn it on in the second half of last year and he realized, you know, this money time, you know, he was as good a defensive end as anyone in the country. You saw that in the bowl game, you know, in the final three games against Ohio State, which is obviously has elite offensive lineman who he was taking, he was just burning those guys. And then Florida State in the bowl game, they didn't have a great offensive line, but you could see what he could do, you know, against high-level talent.
Yeah, Mark, I want to follow up on Taco real quick. And, you know, reading some of the stuff on him and the course of his career, the one word that's thrown out sometimes is inconsistent. But I wonder if some of that inconsistency is the fact that he was given a better opportunity his senior year, like you mentioned, to put up better numbers because the Michigan swapped over to a defense that probably fit his skill set better, and he got
Absolutely.
To play that more traditional 4-3 defensive end rather than playing that 3-4 end spot, which, as you know, you don't really have as many opportunities to rush the passer from that spot.
No, absolutely. I think that's a very good point, and I think that playing in the 4-man line last year really helped him because they had dominant, and he's also playing with other NFL players. So I think that's true of all of these Michigan defensive linemen. When you look at them, you say they played with NFL players, and they all produced still. So you know that shows the ability that they have to play with other elite guys. And I think with Taco, I mean, also at the beginning of last year, he missed the first couple of games with an ankle injury. Mm. You know, he said he suffered in the first game, and then he said he was plagued by it all year. I don't know how much he's, you know, exaggerating that, but he said that, you know, he wasn't completely healthy the whole year. So the numbers he produced late in the year when he wasn't completely healthy, still playing on that ankle, that shows a lot about, you know, what he can do when he's motivated.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the last one for me on Taco real quick. The thing I love about him is that he's 6'5", 277, Mark. You don't see these defensive ends coming out of college anymore. That, you know, a lot of these pass rushers are, you know, 6'3", 245, and, you know, they're, you know, a glorified 3-4 outside linebacker. This guy's got an NFL body, and do you think that in certain passing situations you might be able to move him inside to the three technique, given his strength and also his ability to stop the run?
I don't know about that. I don't know that that's really his move. I mean, maybe if he put on some more weight or something like that. But I haven't seen a lot of that from Taco with his time. Wormley, of course, can do all those things. I mean, he can come from the outside. He can go to the inside. He has the strength. He's one of the strongest guys that they've had. but in recent years. But I don't know if Taco can. I don't know if he can do that. He's a specialist, probably more.
How is Taco on first and second down against the run, though? Just out of curiosity.
I think he's okay. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's necessarily his forte.
Got it.
But I mean, if they, you know, but I don't think. Yeah, I don't know if that's necessarily his strength.
Well, one guy that I think it's safe to say, Mark, that can play inside is Ryan Glasgow as we move to the defensive tackle spot. And clearly he comes from good bloodlines because his brother's with the Detroit Lions. What has jumped out to you? Because, you know, maybe when you look at him and you look at his numbers, they don't jump off the page. Perhaps his athleticism doesn't jump off the page, but he just seems like he'd be a good locker room guy and a good guy if you really want to preach toughness on your team. Is that a fair assessment of his play?
Yeah, I guess so. I think he's really strong, you know, and Ryan is able, and he's such a good technician that what he's done, you know, by holding the middle, no one got past him. You know, I mean, he was able to clog up and take on a double team consistently, and that's what helped Taco, it's helped Wormley, helped other guys around, and he was such a threat. You know, you saw it with Michigan, really, I guess you saw it the year before. I mean, Ryan had played, and he had a pec tear, I guess about two-thirds of the way through his junior season, and he had been playing really well and had emerged as one of the best, you know, best defensive linemen, I guess, in the Big Ten, best tackles. And then he went down, and all of a sudden, Michigan's rush defense, which was number one in the country, vanished. Indiana just put up a huge number on them. Ohio State put up a huge number on them. And Michigan was a different defense, and he was the only change that had made in that, and just removing him. So I think that sometimes with guys, you see the difference and you see their impact, especially defensive tackles, you know, who you don't really get the big numbers out of. You see their impact when they're not there.
You know, it's rare, Mark, that you see a team with three draft-worthy cornerbacks coming out in the same year, and then you could wonder how Michigan had the best defense in college football. Well, it's probably because of these defensive linemen and these cornerbacks that can cover. Can you parse through those three corners for me? What separates them? What makes them different?
Well, Jordan Lewis, obviously, two-time All-American. He's smaller, he's lighter, and no one beats him. I mean, except for the bowl game where there was a coverage mix-up, it seems like, and the safety really didn't help. No one beats Jordan. I mean, and 2 years ago, you know, people were testing him, obviously, because, you know, they didn't know. I mean, he hadn't established himself, I guess, and he was small, so I think they attacked him, and he just continually, I mean, he set a Michigan record for pass breakups at 22 in season. Yeah. And so they kept testing him, and he kept knocking him down, and no one could beat him. And then last year, they didn't throw to him. He didn't play the first four games, I think, because of an injury. But and then from that, the teams didn't test him. I think maybe 30 balls were thrown at him the whole year, something like that, just because they knew that he made plays on all of them. You saw his athleticism and his leaping ability at the end of the Wisconsin game. If you see that film, he made this one-handed interception where he was just absolutely laying out for it. And it was probably a play he didn't need to make. It was fourth down. But the idea that he can make a play like that and bring the ball in, you know, shows his skills, because he really wasn't tested often enough to see, you know, him. I mean, he also made this great interception the year before, I guess as a junior, when they threw to him against Northwestern, threw against him, and he made this play, if you pull up the film, he kind of ripped the ball out, and they caught it at the same time. He ripped it out and ran for a touchdown. It was just one of those plays where, you know, he knew where to be and what, and his technique was so impressive that he was right in the right spot to make a play on it. And so I think Jordan, you know, he doesn't have the body that the other guys have or the size, and I think that's what hurt him. But his production was so elite, you know, for 2 years, I mean, and the Thorpe finalists for 2 years, that you could see, you know, just by watching the film, teams will see that. I think that's kind of the issue with him. In terms of Channing Stribling, you know, Channing was thrown in there really early because of his size. And they got him, he was a 6'2 corner, you know, and I think Brady Hoke's staff, which was before Harbaugh, was looking for big corners because they had a lot of little guys. And so they took the chance on him, and, you know, they threw him in there. And he got burned a couple of times by Allen Robinson in this famous game where Michigan lost, I think, triple overtime at Penn State. And Robinson, I don't know if you've heard the story, but Robinson now has a tattoo of that play. One of those plays on his arm.
That's
with
funny.
Channing in there, which I guess it's funny unless you're Channing. You know? but you know, yeah. But I mean, and Channing just steadily improved, and he kept working at it. And last year he was tested, obviously, a lot because no one threw it against Lewis. And I think that he performed well throughout the year, and he showed the ability to play in coverage and as a big corner to be physical. And they, you know, at Michigan, especially last year, you know, they played, you know, man on man, and they were physical from the line all the way through. And I think that was something that he was able to show that. I think that, you know, maybe Channing's numbers are – the numbers here in the combine and everything aren't so great, but I think that what you see is if you turn on the film, you can see him compete, and he's really physical, and he'll compete. And he's learned to use his size to his advantage. I think that wasn't working so much earlier. He would jump, miss time jumps and stuff, but he really improved as the years went on. Jeremy Clark's an interesting one because he came in as a safety. He was not highly rated. Channing wasn't either, I guess. But, you know, when Clark came in, you know, as a safety, they redshirted him, and he's just always big, 6'4", whatever, and then they needed help at corner, and they moved him to corner, and he was fast enough to play corner. So if you're 6'4", and you're 225, you know, there's always this potential that you really could be a game-changing cornerback in the NFL because there aren't a lot of guys like that. And I think it's because guys that big obviously don't have the speed and the physicality to stay with people. But the thing is, Clark played well the first couple of games last year when Lewis was out and he and Stribling were the two corners. But then he got hurt and he missed the whole season with the ACL tear. The last, 8, 9, 10 games.
Yeah.
And so where is he physically? You know, what can he do? Does he still have that speed? Those are the questions the team's going to have to answer.
Well, and I think that's also related to Jake Butt, the tight end. We'll get to that in a second. I don't want to jump the gun to offense because of his ACL tear. But staying on Lewis, my follow-up question to you, Mark, is the fact that even though he's small, and I think he's projected mainly to be a slot guy, he seems to be very effective in also stopping the run. What have you seen, and maybe overall for the corner group as a whole, but how good are they in terms of providing run support as opposed to what they do when they get down the field in coverage?
Yeah, they did a lot of that last year with under Don Brown, who's the new defensive coordinator of Michigan last year. I think that he really emphasized bringing those guys up, and Lewis embraced it. I mean, Lewis is a great tackler. He was physical, even though he's so small. You know, he was eager to do that. Stribling, not as much, and I think that that's something that he had to work on through the year, and I think that's something maybe he still would have to work on a little bit in terms of run support. But Lewis, yeah, even at his size, he was able to hit big and wrap guys up. But, you know, obviously if it's going to be different if it's a 230-pound running back or if he's trying to take down someone a little smaller than that. So that's where his size may come into play a little bit. I know he's projected as like a nickel corner or slot corner or whatever he's going to be. But I could see he played against bigger receivers, and he was able to handle them. His technique was that good on the outside. We'll see if teams, you know, will embrace that, but he can do it.
Yeah, I don't think anybody wants Jordan Lewis, squaring up Leonard Fournette and trying to take him down the hole.
Right.
I don't think anybody's looking for that. I'm sorry, Mark. Go ahead. What are you going to say?
No. I don't. But knowing Jordan, he wouldn't shy away from it. You know, some guys would be afraid.
He's got that tough
mentality.
Wouldn't
want to do that, but he would take it on.
Nice. All right. Well, let's go to safety. And you talked about Peppers already, but two other safeties coming out. I know DeMonte Thomas, you know, is a guy that probably, you know, might go undrafted, maybe a really late round pick. But Delano Hill is going to be in the mix in the middle rounds, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's interesting. Delano's really quiet, and that's kind of his. It's hard to get a read on him. I think he was very solid. He's not one of these verbal safeties, you know, who's directing everyone everywhere. It's just not his personality, you know. But in terms of technique, and he and Jordan played together in high school, Lewis, and, you know, I think Delano really took to, you know, the position and kind of and flourished last year, especially under Brown and kind of what they did. I mean, Michigan's had NFL experience in terms of these coaches in the secondary, and I think that that's made a big difference. You know, with Hill, he emerged, and it was a steady climb, but he always had the talent, and he can run. And I think that that's really a big part of it. In terms of being physical, you know, I don't know that he's a giant hitter, but he can do a lot of things back there, and I think there's some versatility with him.
You know, it's funny. I would have thought he would have had more production as a coverage guy, given that he ran a 4.47 at the combine, which for a 6'1", 215-pound safety is excellent. But I guess they tended to use him closer to the line of scrimmage more than they used him as a single high deep guy going to sideline to sideline.
Yeah, I think they brought him up a lot, and that was just kind of some of what he did. And, you know, with those corners, I mean, those guys were left alone all the time.
Wow,
that was
okay. Just
kind of the way they did it. They let those guys go, and, you know, that's the nature of Michigan's offense. They said, you know, this is the way we've got to operate. We'll see how that goes this year when they're playing sophomores. But, you know, with seniors and NFL guys, they said, you know, you guys got to take care of your business, and then, you know, we can bring these safeties up, and that can make a big difference. And it helped in the run game for sure.
Yeah, the island mentality, a little bit tougher to digest when you're throwing out the underclassmen as opposed to when you have the veterans. I think that's a fair point. Talking with Mark Snyder, who covers the University of Michigan for the Detroit Free Press. I think we pretty much covered everybody on defense, Mark, so I think it's safe to transition to offense. And I go back to what I was teasing before, the tight end spot. And, you know, this is a deep class at tight end. You could maybe wait to the mid-rounds and still get a quality starter. So, you know, that's where you bring up a guy like Jake Butt, who's got the torn ACL, and you wonder, are teams going to question, can he return to his production value? You know, the numbers are there. Maybe the blocking is a question mark. What's the biggest question mark, though, now entering the draft for him, given the blocking angle as well as the injury angle?
Well, he made a lot of progress with the blocking. Yes, he's not an elite blocker. That's just not who Jake is. He's a natural pass catcher. I mean, he was a basketball player in high school. You know, he can get out and run and make the tough catches. He's not afraid to go into traffic. If you watch his film, he can go in traffic. When he gets the ball, he can move with it. I don't think he's not a guy who flies either. You know, I mean, I don't think he has the physical gifts of O.J. Howard or something like that. But, you know, Jake had great hands. He rarely, if ever, dropped a ball, and he always knew kind of where he was going at all times. You know, I mean, I think that was kind of the nature of Jake, is that he knew the plays, he was incredibly reliable, and he caught everything. You know, in terms of the blocking, he understood that was a weakness, and I think that showed, you know, because he came back for his senior year when he could have gone last year's draft and maybe been drafted higher, you know, just because of the nature of that tight end class. And I mean, I think beyond Hunter Henry, there wasn't a lot going on there. And you saw he came back and he had a very productive season. He didn't match necessarily his pass catching numbers because they spread the ball around, but he never really had an issue with that. In terms of recovering from the ACL, I don't think that's a major issue either, because he's done it before. You look at he tore his ACL his sophomore year. Mm-hmm. He came back in, I think, 8 games, and he had all this production as a 2-time All-American in the years after that. So to think that he can't do it again, I mean, I think – The reason you'd be worried, like I guess when we were talking before about Clark, you know, if he's losing his speed, well, that's when an ACL you're concerned, because you don't know if he's the same player. Well, Jake never had that elite speed anyway. So, you know, if he gets back to what he was, he's what he was. You know, I think that the knee is not really an issue in terms of that.
Also a couple wide receivers coming out from Michigan. Amar Darbo is someone that could even, you know, sneak into day two if everything goes well. He ran a very solid 4.45 at the combine. What would an NFL team be getting if they decide to make him their selection on Friday night?
Yeah, I think that was kind of a surprising run by Amara as well, because we never saw him open up that speed really at Michigan. I mean, but he was always so solid, you know, catching the ball and running precise routes. And he had great hands. I mean, there's a couple times you can look and see he made some one-handed catches that were just fabulous. And what he did, you know, moving around, I mean, they were able to use him in different spots, but he was never the home run guy. So I think the fact that he can run a 4-4, you know, will intrigue teams, because it can show them that maybe there's more there than they saw on film in Michigan. He had his role at Michigan. He filled his role. And Amara was smart enough to basically understand, you know, all the complex issues with the NFL offense that Harbaugh was running, and that he really flourished under it, because he was so solid and steady that he became, for 2 years, I guess last year especially, but Wilton Spate used him a tremendous amount, because he knew that Darbo would always make the play, and Spate was a lot of times breaking tackles in the back and, you know, having to create on the fly, and Darbo was always available as an option. I think that was kind of a unique part of it. He has decent size. You know, he's strong, and he's steadily progressed. And I think that if you're an NFL team, you look at him and you say, well, he's had this steady progression every year, and that's kind of what they want to see, because that's the guy who continues to trend up and obviously knows how to learn.
In terms of the offensive line, I know there's 3 guard prospects that Michigan has, Mark. You know, what mm-hmm. is the difference maybe between the 3, and where do you see them projecting as to whether they could step in perhaps within the first 2 years of NFL experience and actually contribute?
Well, I think Eric Magnuson could be a tackle as well. Ben Braden, he may be more of a guard, even though he played tackle at Michigan somewhat. I think they all bounced around. I mean, Kalis only really played guard. He didn't really play tackle. That was only in high school. But Eric Magnuson, he played on the outside. I don't know if that maybe his feet aren't quick enough to be on the outside, but he played in Michigan. He was pretty solid there, and I think he's the highest projected guy. Or he wasn't invited to the combine, but I think that he could be the highest guy just in terms of production, just because of his talent and what he did. He was very solid. You know, he rarely made major mistakes. Kalis was really up and down. He has that high end potential. He has really that fierceness. You know, you want from a guard, someone who's a mauler, and he has that. His dad played in the NFL. Todd Kalis for a long time. He played with the Broncos for a while. But I think that fire out of Kalis is really something that will appeal to teams. Technique wise, you know, you would see some times when he would maul people, and then you'd see some times when he just, you know, he just let someone run right by him, and you never understood really why that was. So I think that's the thing with Kalis. There was a lot of inconsistency, but he has that high end potential, you know, that really will be appealing teams. And, you know, sometimes these coaches say, well, I can be the one to fix him.
Yeah.
I can be the one to harness that if it's there. In terms of Ben Braden, you know, I was kind of surprised that he was the one invited to the combine, but I think his athleticism really, and you saw it in the numbers at the combine, his speed and athleticism really showed, you know, that he has the ability and the talent to do that kind of stuff. In terms of the technique and stuff, you maybe didn't see it quite as much, and they moved him around. Some of that's because they moved him guard, tackle, and stuff. I don't know if you see the same ferocity out of him as you see out of Kalis and Magnuson and spurts as well, but he definitely has the athleticism over the other two.
Did Michigan run mostly his own blocking scheme in terms of the running game, or was it mostly a power man-to-man type thing?
They went power, you know, recently, the last couple of years. I mean, they had done some zone earlier in those guys' careers, and all those guys were thrown in there. It's kind of an interesting situation in Michigan. Those guys were all thrown in really young under Brady Hoke, you know, they're as redshirt freshmen, basically, and they got crushed, you know? I mean, it was one game. It was one game, 13 or 14, against Michigan State when Michigan ran for negative 48 yards because there were so many sacks. And,
wow.
And they just, it was a record. It was a record in the history of Michigan football. And a lot of those guys were on the field, and there were no answers. They, you know, it was just basically they had some young guys. They had talent, but they had to work their way up. And then by last year, you know, they were doing pretty well. I mean, they didn't have a 1,000-yard rusher in any of those years. Some of that's because of the rotation. I guess we'll talk about that with Devion Smith, but the idea, you know, that those guys improved over the years, that none of them ever became elite. Eric Magnuson was an all Big Ten, but I don't think anyone would consider any of those guys elite prospects. But they all improved as the years went on. And I think that, again, with an NFL team, you want to see progress. You don't want to see regression.
Well, you brought up Devion Smith, so, I mean, I'm curious where you see him plugging in because, you know, when you look at running backs, at least I'm looking at it through the Giants' lens here, Mark. If you were to look at maybe what the Giants' need would be, it would be more of a power type of back. When you look at Devion, you're talking about a player that's 5'11", seems to be more of a shifty type of back. Is he seemed to be a third down?
No, he's power. He's
you
power.
You
he's
think
a
that
power
he could
guy.
Provide power
yeah.
on the next level? Okay.
He's a power guy because he doesn't have the speed. He doesn't have the speed shifty. His feet are okay, and he can get in and out, but he really doesn't. You don't see the takeoff speed in, you know, in the NFL level. I don't think that he has that. I think that he's got to be someone, you know, he's a wonderful pass protector, and that's really what Michigan loved
yeah.
about him.
Oh, interesting.
You know, and Harbaugh especially, just because that's why he was the starter, really, for the last couple of years. He didn't have the breakaway speed. I mean, you saw a couple long runs, but really those were very rare. You saw a couple big games, but, you know, those were only occasionally. And he played through injuries. I mean, tough kid, obviously, you know, and he's very physical. But you've seen in both the pro day and in the combine, he did not have elite run. He didn't run in the combine. And then when he ran at the pro day, it wasn't that fast. So I think that's something he still needs to prove, some of that speed. I think that's going to hurt him. But in terms of being able to pick up stuff, you know, and as a pass protector, that's a really underrated trait. And I think that those are the things that NFL teams are going to start to appreciate about Michigan's draft class this year and then going forward, is that Tim Drevno, the offensive line coach, and Jim Harbaugh are stressing to them the things you need to succeed in the NFL, not necessarily, you know, those traits that just make you a great college player. And that's where Devion's going to help, because I think anyone who looks at their film sees what a massive role he played for Michigan protecting the quarterback.
Well, and I think you bring up a good point there, Mark, and that was going to be my last question to you about how the philosophy really has changed at Michigan, and maybe this is why we're looking at a group of almost 20 prospects this year that could wind up with NFL teams. You go back to Harbaugh's days with the Niners, Mark, you know, he had a very good offensive line. He had Frank Gore, and I think those were staples of why San Francisco succeeded. Do you feel as if that's transitioned now to Michigan, where maybe how we view Michigan prospects is going to change over the next few seasons here?
Oh, I think so, yeah, and there's going to be more Michigan prospects in the draft. I mean, look through the Rich Rodriguez years and the Brady Hoke years, you know, I guess that was 7 years in the last couple, I guess, is the leftover of Hoke. You know, there was only two or three guys a year. I mean, there were a couple good ones, you know, Brandon Graham, you had, but he was recruited under Lloyd Carr. And then you had, I mean, you had a couple guys. You had Lawan, yeah, Michael Schofield, yeah, starter for the Broncos. You know, and you've had moments, but for the most part, you know, you haven't had sustained. And I think that across the board, they're getting the most out of these guys. Now, Hoke's staff, Brady Hoke's staff, recruited all these guys. So, you know, he gets credit for that. But the development wasn't showing those first 2 years. None of them were looked like NFL players those first 2 years. Peppers, he was even injured that year. But obviously everyone knew he was going to be an NFL player. But the rest of the guys, you know, even the ones who were highly rated, you weren't sure. And I think that what these last couple of years, the player development under Harbaugh has been dramatic. And I think that's why the team has improved. And I think now you're seeing that with the NFL draft.
A final question for me, and it goes to special teams. Kenny Allen, first of all, I think you guys might have a punter drafted this year. It catches my eye, 6'4", 222 pounds. You don't see many punters at 6'4", 222. So you can kind of give me a lowdown on him. Is he a power leg guy? Is he a directional kicking guy? And then on top of that, we haven't really touched on special teams much in terms of the guys we've talked about. Any of these guys that you think coming out could really be impact special teams players in the NFL? Because as you well know, that's where these guys are going to butter their bread their first couple years in the league.
Jabril definitely can.
Well,
I mean,
yes,
look,
yeah,
he was fifth in the nation in punt returns last year. And some of the punt returns, you know, if you can get a hold of this film, some of the punt returns that were called back because of holding calls or something like that were more impressive, you know, than anything he actually produced. I mean, when you go and look at just write this down, the Rutgers film,
okay,
you can find the play in the first half. He did this. He returned this punt where he ended up going under a tackler because the guy went high and he went under him and took it in. And it was magnificent, and it was called back, so he never got the payoff for it. But it was something you don't ever see.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
Return. And Jordan Lewis has those skills too. We saw a little bit of it when Peppers was taken off. You know, the kick returns late in the year and the punt returns 2 years ago, and you saw some of the explosion. And I think Lewis has that ability, and especially if he's just playing, you know, in the slot corner, you could see him get in the mix with some team and be able to do that, and make an impact. In terms of Kenny Allen, it was kind of surprising that he didn't get invited to the combine, I think for a number of reasons, but maybe the biggest one is that he can do everything. Last year, you know, he was one of the rare guys, I think there were four or five guys in the country, who did kickoff specialist, place kicking, and punting, and he did all of those last year, and which was really unique, I think, that in his ability. I mean, I know people view him as a punter, and maybe his strength is that's what he can do, but he has the ability to do everything, and for a team to bring him in as a punter, but know he can do kickoffs, know he can do those other things, you know, then they have the flexibility. I think someone's going to take a chance on him only for that reason, because they know that they can move him into a different spot when they get an injury or you have someone on your roster who's versatile like that.
You know, we actually just brought up the return here, Mark, and it was as advertised. That was pretty darn impressive. Final thing real quick before we say goodbye. Anybody on coverage teams really jump out to you in terms of, you know, maybe being a gunner or helping out on kick and punt coverage that you think can really make an impact early in their NFL career?
Out of these guys?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think I could see Delano Hill being pretty aggressive. Demonte Thomas definitely you know, has that ability. I could definitely see him doing some of that.
Great. Hey, Mark, we really appreciate the time. We know you kept you a while. Thank you so much. A lot of guys coming out from Michigan this year, I'm sure. This trend will continue over the next few years now as Jim Harbaugh's kids that he recruited start to kind of make their way through that Michigan pipeline, all right?
Thanks a lot, Mark. Appreciate
it. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, great stuff. Mark Snyder, Detroit Free Press, covers Michigan football. Fantastic job. And now it's time for you to get involved on the phones at 201-939-4513. I think we should add Salomon down here doing this spot. You know, we gave him the ecstasy of the Beanie Wells, Ohio State spot. I think we should have made him suffer through the Michigan spot.
True, to balance it out, in fairness.
Yeah.
To see the joy that is brought to him and then the irritation that is brought towards
him. Or Sperling. We could add Sperling down here do it.
That's true. He's more of a Michigan guy, so he would have been joyous under the circumstances. We would have pleased two people within the department.
Yeah.
Based on our interviews. Yes.
And that's two more than we usually please.
That's true. There you go. Moving up in the world. There
Absolutely.
We go. The rankings.
201-939-4513. But really, it's a deep class, Lance. Maybe two or three players in the first couple rounds. But I think rounds 3 through 5, the same way it was when we did Miami last week, I think you're going to have a lot of players in the middle rounds coming out of Michigan.
Well, I think you can say the same thing about Ohio State, too,
yeah,
which
absolutely.
Has a lot of depth as well. I would throw that school in the mix. But I would agree with you. I think that there's going to be some good finds in the mid-rounds where Michigan players are going to be selected. And I think they actually have some reasonable shots to perhaps be instantaneous contributors in year one. I mean, I brought up Ryan Glasgow. I've been very impressed with what I've heard and what I've seen out of him. And, I don't think he's going to be a first-rounder, but I think he's going to be a guy that whoever does take him, could get a nice impactful player in the mix there.
Yeah, and he's not going to be a first rounder, not because he's not really good at what he does. It's just because that position that he plays doesn't profile.
Correct.
Generally, he's a first round pick. He's not a pass rusher. He's not going to get sacks.
Yeah.
But he is a poor man's Snacks Harrison, where he's going to come in, stuff the middle of that
first
line.
First and second down.
And help the other guys in the line be more productive.
Yeah, and I think it'll be a good locker room presence, too. So that's why we talk about
depth. He was a walk-on, by the way.
Yeah,
that just goes to show you
how far some of these guys have come. And there's some players out of other schools, too, where they were, written off and, on the middle of nowhere in terms of the rankings. And
look at Garrett Bowles. He went to community college for 2 years. Yeah. Ramchek, he was at Stevens Point, Division III. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, some of it is because of injury history and the guys weren't necessarily ready to play at this level. But, it truly is amazing when you look at some of the paths and the stories behind some of these prospects. But getting back to Michigan and looking at some of these players that I think had come in and, day one make an immediate impact, there are certainly plenty of guys here, whether it be at the defensive tackle spot, the safety spot, I think is another one to watch out for,
yep.
As well as the cornerback spot, too. We just heard from Mark. I mean, three cornerbacks out of Michigan, and Jordan Lewis, I think, gets the majority of the notoriety, but, the other two have some decent size, and you could do far worse if you're picking in the third or the fourth round and you want to add some depth to your cornerback crew and you add some sizable commodities that Michigan has to showcase. Once again, that's where you build the depth chart in the draft, no matter what team you are, and this is the year that I think if you're going in and you're saying, maybe we don't need a bunch of starters, and I think the Giants fit this profile.
Sure.
They're going in, you look at the defense, and you're like, their starters are in good shape, but this is a year where, you could say to yourself, if we lose guys down the road in free agency or we lose somebody due to injury, you could really make huge strides in terms of your 5, 6, and 7 guys on the depth chart, I think, in a draft like this.
This is a draft where you restock the cupboard. And, you might be eating dinner and you have, you got DRC and Janoris Jenkins and Neil Apple at the dinner table where they're eating their food. But you're right. What happens when DRC's contract's up in a couple of years? Or, Janoris Jenkins, in 3 years, he's getting a little bit older.
Yeah.
Whatever. You want to have that fourth round corner that you picked maybe this year that after 2 years of development is ready to step in and be a starter. And you're right. It's important to draft like this where it's so deep on the defensive side of the ball to draft these guys that – even if they're not going to help now, that might annoy some fans. Like, well, why the hell are they picking a cornerback in the third round? He's not going to play. Why the heck are they picking a pass rusher in the second round? He's the fourth, third guy in our depth chart. Why are we wasting a pick on him? It's because in 2 or 3 years, you never know when you need a starter to step in.
Well, and that relates to, I remember when we did the Ohio State spot, a lot of the players who are now entering the draft, nobody heard of them when they were freshmen or sophomores because those kids were on the back end of the depth chart. And then what happens when Eli Apple leaves and some of these other notable commodities, they then get pushed into starting roles and they thrive. So if you're the Giants, I think you could look at it in a very similar way where, yeah, you don't necessarily need starters on the defensive line, or I should say defensive end specifically, and maybe perhaps at cornerback. But you know what? Things change. Free agency changes. Salary caps change. And you can always have players that can 2 or 3 years from now become your starters, and then you don't have to knock on the door of free agency. And think about how that changes your entire outlook as an organization.
Well, you mentioned stories, and I didn't have a chance to ask him about it. Before we get to your calls, we'll come in a second. Their wide receiver, Amara Darboe, he's one of those stories. His family fled Sierra Leone to avoid civil war there, came, lived in Des Moines, Iowa, of all places, when he was 7 years old, became a citizen in 2015, and basically, at Michigan, became a citizen in the United States. So there are stories just like that all over this draft of guys that, have come here and come a long way to kind of, have a chance to secure themselves for the rest of their lives if they get drafted in the right spot and put together a 6, even a 5 to 7 year NFL career you're going to make enough money where you're not set for life, but you're putting yourself in very good position to be successful.
Yeah, and that's why I asked Mark about just how the culture of the program has changed, because I think, you know, what Harbaugh has done with some of the guys that he mentioned that Brady Hoke brought in, you know, that just goes back to sometimes we look about how coaches, if they have great players, they can get by. But this is an example, I think, of what's going on at Michigan is the difference in coaching is the difference in terms of how far the players have moved from year one to maybe year two or year three.
Do you know what it reminds me of? When you have these NFL coaches show up in college and you see the turnaround like that, reminds me of when Pete Carroll went back to USC. He took all the stuff he did in the pros. You know, he probably sold to his recruits that, look, I can turn you into good pros. You bring pro coaches. You teach pro systems. You teach them pro schemes in some cases. The Harbaugh's still using very much a collegiate scheme offensively in terms of using some spread and things like that. But if you teach these guys at the level you teach NFL players, they're going to be more prepared to come into the league. And they're going to be more effective in coverage and in college. And like Mark said, there's a reason these guys develop more under Harbaugh's coaching staff. It's because he's bringing in pro-level coaches. Oh, yeah. And that's how – and tell you what, it worked with Pete Carroll in USC, and I would not be surprised for as long as Jim Harbaugh is at Michigan. And I think it'll be for probably at least 3 to 5 years before he decides to maybe give the pros another shot. This program is going to be in the mix every year.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be in a rush necessarily to leave, especially if you can make a name for yourself at your alma mater, by the way, where he played. But you did bring up a good point, and I think with Harbaugh, remember, you know, he was at the collegiate level before he went to the NFL.
At Stanford,
so
obviously.
He's got experience both ways, and, you know, you mentioned about him bringing NFL-caliber coaches. If I'm a freshman or I'm a sophomore and my ultimate goal is to get to the NFL, I think I'd be probably in more of a position to want to listen to positional coaches who have been in the NFL and have done that, because if they're pushing me and they're telling me to do certain things, they're coming from a level where they know what it takes to be a consistent NFL player and actually hang around there, not just be a guy that flashes for 1 year.
I mean, yeah,
so that's
example,
part of the message.
If, and I'm not sure if this coach is even there, but just to give an example, if he brings in a guy and says, hey, freshman, idiot, this guy coached Justin Smith to become an all-pro, this guy coached Frank Gore to become a 10,000-yard running back in the, you know, in the NFL. He might go to the Hall of Fame, Frank Gore, with all his overall numbers. Not sure I would vote him
in. He's had a great season with the Colts all of a sudden,
absolutely,
too, by the way.
So, you know, and when you throw those names around and you show the resume, you're right. Kids are going to be more likely to listen to those guys than some guy that, frankly, they don't know who they are, and they can't throw those names at them. So, it's interesting. 201-939-4513, hashtag Giants Chat on Twitter. Let's go to Jeff in New Hampshire. He's up first. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Doing great, Jeff. What's up?
Oh, not much. Just with the Michigan day today, one of the players that they have is on my short list of players I hope we end up with.
Who, Taco?
And that was Taco, yeah.
Hey, he's a good player. I would not complain about that.
He was on my short list even before we signed JPP, because I remember when we drafted JPP, we still had Justin Tuck and Osu Mignore in their prime, and we drafted JPP. Some people didn't like that. I thought it was great. Just because we have JPP and OV, I would still go after Carlton. I think the two Super Bowl championships we had three really good defensive ends, so I have no problem going for a third. A couple of things about him I really like. I like the long arms. You know, I like the kind of plays that Umanure and Tuck made in their prime when they couldn't get the sack. They got their hands up. They could deflect passes. They could get in the quarterback's passing lanes. I see some of that in Carlton. I see a little bit of versatility, like he's athletic with his height. Watching him at the combine, you know, he can kind of drop back into the flat into coverage. Kind of, you know, we like to drop defensive linemen back and bring blitzes from other positions. I think he gives us some versatility there. I think the biggest weakness that I've read about him is in run support. And from some of the scouting things I read, it's all correctable and coachable. It's not necessarily, you know, a physical thing that he can't do. It's more on coaching. So I think that type of defensive end would be really good for us. And I think He's probably in that sweet spot where need meets value. He wouldn't be a reach, and I think it's realistic for him to be there at 23, although I've seen some mocks that have him going a lot higher than that. I think it's all in the eye of the beholder where he's going to go. But there's not a lot of barring like an Njoku or a Howard dropping, which may or may probably won't happen. I think he's one of the very few players at the top of my list anyway, and I think he'd be well-served to get another defensive end pass rusher.
Well, and if you look at the philosophy of the Giants organization, I mean, they value
that would not
pass
be a
rushers.
Surprise.
So I would agree with you, Jeff. I would not be surprised either if when they get to 23, that's the position of note. And I'm going to stand by that regardless of what transpires between now and the start of the draft. I mean, that's just a philosophy, a core philosophy of the organization. You know, you threw out some mock drafts. I referenced this on yesterday's show. I'm bringing up the four NFL.com mock drafts. I'm just curious where they have Taco going.
And, you know, I've seen him going anywhere from like 10 to 25. Like, he is a very big range in terms of where I see him going.
NFL.com, I think one of them has him at 30 and another one's got him at like 9.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, the first one's got him at 30. The second one's got him at 31. Then the third one has him all the way up at 19. And then let's see what the fourth one has as I peruse that one. Let's see, is Taco. They have him at 29. So it seems as if you go by NFL.com, that 29 to 31 is the barometer, but 19, one guy has him high. And that's all it takes. All it takes is one team that's high on him. And the one player that they're comparing him to, by the way, is Chandler Jones, who was with the Patriots and has since been traded to the Cardinals and was just given the franchise
tag. And Dane Brugler, who we'll have on before this draft comes our way, we have his draft guide here. Just came out a couple days ago. You guys can check it out. You go to @DPBrugler. On Twitter, you can link to purchase it there. It's really the best draft guide. We have it every year. It's a fantastic resource. And again, we'll have Dane on to talk about it in a couple weeks. He has him as his 35th best player on his big board. So
overall,
yes, of all positions. And again, sometimes with need,
it
guys
changes.
Will go up, and defensive ends are considered a premium position. So if I had to guess, Jeff, and you put a gun to my head and you said, John, will he be there when the Giants pick at 23? I would probably say yes, but I wouldn't be that sure about it.
I wouldn't be positive. I mean, I think he will be too, and I think he's going to be better. I think there's a small chance Njoku falls. There's no chance Howard falls. Other than that, I can't really think of a player I'd want over him. I'm on the fence. It's him or Forrest Lamp. I can make a really good case for Forrest Lamp too. But other than those two, barring like something unexpected, you know, a top 10 or a top 15 overall player drops for some reason, you know, something crazy happens, four quarterbacks go in the top 20. I think he may be the best player on the board, and if not him, it could be a similar pass rusher, maybe a Derek Barnett or a Charles Harris. But out of all the pass rushers that I think are realistic for us, I don't want to attack McKinley. I don't want one of those tweener types.
How about Watt?
Traditional 4-3 end.
Do you like T.J. Watt?
I'm thinking Carlton's our guy.
Do you like T.J. Watt, or do you think he's too much of a tweener?
He's an outside linebacker.
I agree with you.
I'm old fashioned when it comes to that. I want to know I'm getting a defensive end, especially in a first round pick.
Hey, look, Jeff.
I don't care for the small guys.
That's why when I ask Mark the question, when I see a guy at defensive end that's 6'5", 270 pounds, my eyes immediately open because that screams to me 4-3 defensive end that is not only going to be a pass rusher but also do a decent job setting that edge.
It just too much reminds me of Umanyora and Tuck. You know, the long arms like Umanyora, the kind of plays those he could make, the size and the strength that Tuck had. I mean, those are two of the best players we've had in, 25 years, and they helped us win championships. And when you see some of the similar traits, plus I'm kind of biased when I go to offensive and defensive linemen coming out of the Big Ten. You know, that conference is known for the physical style of football.
In the trenches, yeah.
Yeah, Wisconsin and Michigan State, Michigan, Ohio State, they all
Iowa
have very
especially.
Good. Iowa, too. They all have very good pedigree in terms of developing offensive linemen. Jeff, we got to run, man. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, good stuff. Let's go to Charlie in Portland, Maine. Charlie, I'd play your open, but we're running low on time, so I'm just going to go to you instead. What's up, Charlie?
Well, that's a
no
relief.
Problems. Hey, Lance. Hey, John.
How are we doing?
What I don't understand is why is Peppers considered a negative when the guy can play like 5-6 positions? This guy has to be so athletic and so have a high, athletic ability and mental ability to be able to play 4 or 5 positions and to change on a dime to do it. This guy, when he comes in the NFL and he can focus on one position, this guy is going to excel and be an incredible player.
Right, but again, Charlie, remember, that's a projection. He hasn't shown that he's great at one position yet. Like in college, his primary position was 4-3 strong side linebacker. He's 205 pounds. He ain't doing that in the pros. So you're projecting if he can do the things that other positions in the NFL are going to ask of him. And that's why I think people see that as a negative, because you don't know if he's going to be as good at safety in the NFL as he was at linebacker in college, simply because he wasn't asked to do safety things in college 90% of the time. And that's why I think people look at it as a bit of a red flag. It's the old jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none type of situations,
Well, I mean, the example I'll use is Pugh. you know, when we had Pugh, what did we do? We put him at right tackle, then we put him over here, we put him over there. What happened when we focused him on one position, left guard? He became
But Pugh player. Doesn't have the same background as Peppers. Pugh wasn't a Swiss Army knife in college, though. So I get what you're saying, Charlie. He was moved around a little when he came to the NFL. But we're talking about two positions, essentially.
Yeah, and those are on the offensive line. Peppers played offense. He played secondary.
Return
he played guys, linebacker.
Special teams.
You know, it's a lot easier to go from guard to tackle than it is to go from linebacker to safety. You know what I mean?
Well, I think if he's there in the bottom of the first round and the beginning of the second round, and no one's picked him, I hope the Giants move up and get this guy. Because Spags will utilize him to his max. And the thing is, I'm not sold on Darian Thompson. He might be in the line of every other safety that we've had who's injured all the time. You know,
Charlie, the only problem...
He hasn't proved that he can be on the field yet. So now, I would grab him in a heartbeat.
I'm not telling you...
So anyway, guys...
Now, Charlie, look, real quick, I'm not telling you Peppers isn't going to be a good player. I think he's going to be. But here's my only problem with it. If Peppers becomes a great safety in the NFL, he's going to be a great safety the same way Landon Collins is a great safety. They're going to play the same exact position. Who's the Giants' deep center fielder in coverage if both those two guys are your two safeties? I don't think either of those guys, ideally, when they're playing their best football, are necessarily going to be great at being that single high deep safety. And I think that's the issue you run into also.
Well, I think he also can play the slot. So, I don't know. I think the guy you're getting like two or three players out of one.
Oh, you might be right.
I would grab him. And McCaffrey's the same.
Yeah,
type of
I'm glad you brought him up. We talked about him yesterday, and I was going to say, you know, the team that has a game plan for McCaffrey and Peppers is going to be the ideal fit. Because they at least have a structured view of where they want to use them, as opposed to we just bring him in and flip a coin.
Sure.
And tomorrow he's a safety, the next day he's a linebacker. I just don't think somebody like that's going to thrive under those circumstances.
Understandable.
All right, guys.
Thanks, Charlie.
Appreciate the call.
And that's why I think Peppers is a high risk, might be a little strong, but I think he's a bit of an unknown. Like you said, you have to figure out where to play him. You draft a guy like Hassan Reddick's probably Zach Cunningham. You know, he's going to be your middle linebacker. That's his role. You know what he's going to do. You got to figure out how you're going to use Peppers and fit him into your system, which is why high risk, I think, maybe is a little bit strong, but you get my point.
Well, and then I think it goes back to need, too, if you're just focusing on Peppers for the Giants.
Yeah, right.
Once again, I get Charlie's concern about some of the injury history to the safeties, but I think you brought up a really good point. Collins and Peppers, I don't know if they complement one another. It's almost like they're a duplication of two really good athletes who can cover
and
a
good
lot.
Players.
Yeah, good players, not to take. But if you're going to put somebody with Collins, I think what the Giants are looking for is they're looking for that deep center fielder that can, you know, follow the ball and track the ball and let Collins do his thing in terms of roaming around the line of scrimmage.
Like if you compare Malik Hooker with Landon Collins,
that's a different
who's
story.
More of a coverage guy, boom, sign me up. I'm in. Bing, bang, boom.
Yeah.
But Malik Hooker's not going to be there at 23.
Of course. You got to be realistic. But look at the two safeties in the NFL, at least that jump out to me, the Seahawks. It's the fact that those two complement one another, and you don't have a duplication.
Hey,
that's
Dave,
the key.
Is this Eric in Orlando, or is it Erie? It is Erie. Erie's down in Orlando. Erie, how are you? You got John Schmelk and Lance Meadow. You're our cleanup hitter today, final call of the show. How are you?
How you doing, sir? I'm good. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
Of you guys. It's a first-time call. I'm a first-time caller. I hear your program every day.
Very nice.
It's an honor talking to you guys because all I do is hear you guys every day.
It's our honor talking to you.
Yeah, thanks for making the call.
So basically, I just have two points real quick. Odell, I think that sometimes people tend to exaggerate a little bit with the way these players act nowadays when they're a little bit too out of where they're supposed to be in the being professional.
Yes.
So basically, if you look at Deion Sanders, if you look at all the other players, I can't right off my head right now remember, but if you look at all those other players, they always had that little spunk to them that made them who they are. You can't basically change what they are because that's who they are. I mean, it just makes them way better than, you know, what their potential to the max. You know, I mean, it just, there's something to it. I used to be a football player, so I just know, I kind of know what they're talking about and the way they feel sometimes, the way they over go to that extent limit to, you know.
No, look, well, we hear you. We agree, and I don't think you want to take his spark away from him. The issue you come into is when that spark turns into penalties on the field and it hurts the team. And that's the type of stuff you're looking to avoid. If he stays as energetic and as enthusiastic and things like that, and it all has a positive effect and he's dancing around and having a good time, the fans go, that's fantastic, that's great. It's when the yellow starts flying out or it's distractions and things like that, that's when you have to, you know, not tamper with it, not, you know, degrade it, but finesse it. So that it's all positive energy and it doesn't turn into anything negative. You know what I mean?
That it's focused on the right things. But, you know, Erie, what you're bringing up is an important claim when it comes to sports. It's emotional. And I think people tend to lose sight of that. And sometimes when you're in the heat of the battle, you are emotional and you're not necessarily thinking straight. And I'm not saying that that applies to Odell Beckham, but I do think that part of the narrative for him, especially if you look at the numbers, and I don't have my chart in front of me, the penalties, the way people were talking about Odell Beckham was if, what you were pointing out, John, he was constantly getting penalties and they were constantly hurting the team.
Which was rare.
Which was a false narrative.
Correct.
There were games where he had a penalty, but to say that it was a large volume consistently during the course of the season is false because there's no evidence to support that or back that
up. I would say the more legitimate criticism last year is that too often there were, you know, people asking him questions about stuff that had nothing to do with the game in the locker room week in, week out. And, and you know, some of that in some ways can be molehills being made into mountains by people out there just trying to make a story out of a star in the league. It happens to everybody. All the stars get, you know, all sorts of questions that maybe I think don't make a whole lot of sense to them. But other times there were very legitimate topics because of things that he has said or done that they asked him about. And occasionally that can turn into a distraction. And I think as he gets older and he matures, I think that's going to happen less and less, Erie, to be honest with you.
Definitely. And, I definitely think we should get one more cornerback in the draft. That's definitely a must because of what happened to Carmody. And I'll take this question off the air. And what's the situation with Jonathan Hankins right now? And, guys, keep on doing your good job.
Thank you, Erie.
And I appreciate you guys every day.
All right, Erie.
And we appreciate you listening and watching. You guys, we wouldn't have a show. So I'll hit Hankins real quick. It's wait and see. I mean, he's on the free agent market. He's weighing his options, and we'll see what he decides to do.
Yeah, I mean, no news is good news, as I always say for the Giants. As long as he's on the market, I still think they have a shot to bring him back. But there really hasn't been any new developments. And, you know, the closer and closer we get to the draft, I mean, this could go well after the draft if that's the case, Jerry.
Absolutely. Look, and I don't know anything. Lance and I aren't peddling inside information here. But in my opinion, and I hope I'm wrong, because if he could sign a long-term deal with the Giants, that would be fantastic. My guess, wherever he winds up, even if it's here, he's going to want another go with this free agency thing next year. I think whatever happens now, and again, just my opinion, and for the Giants' sake, I'm sure they hope that it's a long-term contract to get him here for a long time, and I hope that happens too. My guess is that he's going to want a one-year deal, and then he's going to try to do this again next year.
Well, listen, if Dontari Poe took a one-year deal in Atlanta, then I would agree with you, John. I don't think it's a stretch to think Hankins may want to peruse and look for other options later on, and look at the defensive tackle market. Very few guys got long-term deals anyway.
Brandon Williams was the one exception to the rule.
He set the market. Other than that, everybody else had to settle for one- or two-year deals. As far as the corner claim, I mean, you look at the Giants' depth chart right now. We mentioned we know they have their top three. They brought in Valentino Blake, who I think is going to be somebody to watch out for, specifically maybe more on special teams.
Good depth.
The guy that has some starting experience with Pittsburgh.
He's played a lot of snaps on defense in the league. So
I mean,
he's a lot
that's
of
a nice veteran to have. And the Giants have had some veterans like that, like a Trevin Wade or somebody who, you know, has been around the block and so forth. Dante Dion, I think, is a player to watch during the spring. I'm not saying he's a lock to make the roster, but he impressed Spags.
Yep.
During training camp.
He's just undersized.
That's the limitations that
Which
he's going to bring to the
him.
Table. Well, of course. I always can relate. Trindon Holiday. Remember, I was banking on him making the team, and then
Kiss of
his
death.
Hamstring did not cooperate.
And I don't think he ever played another snap in the league again.
No, he did not. See, this is what happens.
So
when I get behind
Lance
the guys.
Lance Meadows single-handedly destroyed his career.
So maybe I shouldn't say anything about Dante Dion. I'll let everybody interpret that as they feel. But you at least have some options when, you know, you look at some of the corners that are in here. But I would agree. I still think that there's ample room to bring in a young player who may not have a large role year one. But like we mentioned, when DRC's contract comes up two or three years in, you can at least get the point where you figure you have another young guy that could step in.
Yeah, I'm going to jump on the corner question because our man Avery at TQ Man AF said he wants to draft a slot corner to have a good backup there in case DRC happens to get hurt like he did last year. in the playoff game, which obviously hurt them in the second half against Green Bay. By the way, D'Orsi did a great job fighting through injuries all of last year. He played, remember, was it the Viking game where his leg was taped up top to bottom trying to deal with that hamstring thing?
The Packer game too, wasn't he?
It was the Packer game.
It was the Packer
game. That's exactly, it was the Packer game. Thank you. Those games were back-to-back, but it was the Packer game. I think he actually had to sit out the Viking game, if I'm not mistaken.
You may be right, because Apple was hurt around the Packer game too. I think he got hurt in the Packer game.
Correct, and that's why D'Orsi tried to fight it through by taping up his leg.
Yeah, the two of them, yeah.
And my point is that, I made to Avery, I already tweeted to him, but Jordan Lewis, a guy we just talked about from Michigan, would actually be one of those slot corners to target in rounds two or three.
Yeah.
Little undersized, he's 5'10", 190, really good quickness, good cover guy, so that would be somewhere too.
Yeah, Lewis is certainly an attractive piece there.
Did you look at Mike Farmer's tweet to you? I don't want to read it. I want to let you address it if you want. If you don't want to address it, that's fine, but you can check it out, yes. That would be at SPRTSFan15. It's in your things.
Oh, please. You know,
I wasn't going to bring it up myself. I was going to let you address it if you wanted to.
I don't think we need to have a debate on this program. No, I'll address it. I mean, we talked about it off the top. What, about Tony Romo and whether or not, you know, he's not getting his due diligence and due justice?
I believe he suggests that you're on Jerry Jones's payroll.
Listen, my viewpoint of Tony Romo is perhaps different than most people, you know, who've watched football. I think he's an underrated and underappreciated quarterback. If you look at what he's done throughout the course of his career and overcome injuries and, you know, help the Cowboys get in a position where they can compete for a playoff spot. Like I said, I think there's more than enough evidence. He didn't win a Super Bowl, but you know what? Dan Marino, Dan Fouts, Steve McNair, Warren Moon, none of those guys won Super Bowls too. And
hey,
I don't think we think any less of them as well.
And here's the bottom line. What's missing, he has everything on his resume except playoff success. That's what's missing. And part of that is his fault. He's had some bad playoff games. He had the drop snap against the Seahawks in that wild card game.
Which was a special teams play.
Correct.
Wasn't a quarterback
play.
And
that did prompt the rule changes with the K-balls as well.
Absolutely.
So that they're now neutral. But he is missing playoff success on his resume, and that is a fair. If you want to have a detracting statement towards him, that's fair. But it's also a team sport, and you need help from your teammates as well.
And that's my biggest point.
Correct.
I mean, the fact that you have to look at, for example, when they played the Packers in 2014, DeMarco Murray had a fumble, which killed momentum, and the Dez Bryant catch, no catch, who people still want to debate, forget the rule.
It was no catch, by the way.
But it had nothing to do with Tony Romo in terms of his execution as a quarterback.
I mean, it's the same thing we talked about Eli Manning the last few years. There, you know, he played great in that first half against the Packers. What happened? Drop passes.
Yeah, exactly. So those are the things, and that's the thing about quarterbacks. You look at Romo, even from an individual statistical standpoint, if you don't remember the drop passes in games or plays, you're not going to do justice to the conversation. And by the way,
well, the quarterback always gets too much blame and too much credit.
Well, and that's a big part of this conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Plus, here's the other thing. Tony Romo's played in 6 playoff games. He has 8 touchdowns and 2 interceptions.
Is he really 8
and
2?
Yeah, 8
pretty good.
Does that sell you?
And what is he, 2-4 in those playoff games?
2-4 with a record. Mm-hmm. Yes, but here's the thing. Quarterback records to me are completely meaningless because that's not taking into consideration special teams and defense. It's just like the one thing I can't stand in the NFL is quarterback records also against quarterback records.
I really set him off.
Well, you did set him. No, no, because because there's a difference between looking at numbers and then having a fair conversation. Good, let him shake. Trust me, I will have a conversation with him at the lunch table too.
Oh, God,
we'll,
really?
That's the show after the show. You may want to sit at a different table.
I'm going to go eat lunch in my office
well,
now.
I'm just wondering, my last point here is quarterback records against other quarterback records completely meaningless.
I agree with that too.
Completely meaningless. Eli Manning is not defending Tom Brady, and Tom Brady is not defending Eli Manning. Mm-hmm. So how does it hold any water whatsoever? So there you go.
So I'll have to keep that in mind next time you make any LeBron James, Michael Jordan comparisons.
Well, you can. Listen, I've always given my fair share of respect to LeBron James as a player. But if we're talking about the GOAT, that's a different story. I never said Tony Romo's the GOAT. I respect him as a player. When you're talking about the GOAT, nobody said Tony Romo's the GOAT. There you go. All right? Anything else you want to cover? You want to bring up other tweets? And you could tell Mr. Farmer to continue his exchange on social media. I'll be more than welcoming and more than welcoming waiting for him to have the discussion. All right?
I didn't even mean to have that.
No, listen, I am fine. I am more than fine, relaxed. I think that's a good point to wrap up.
I will say this. So yes. If they do, in fact, take Sims out of that spot in CBS and replace him with a rookie with the A-team, again, I think Romo will do a good job, but I don't agree with that necessarily.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the argument about whether or not you should at least pay your dues for a season or two.
Pay your dues.
Yes, and I think that despite his intellect as a football commentator. I don't think it hurts to put him.
Different skill set.
Yeah, on the third or the fourth team. And then when you want to then, in a year or two, bring him on with Jim Nantz, that's fine. Because here's the thing. He's going to get exposure no matter where you put him. He doesn't have to be in the number one team to get that exposure.
I'll tell you what, Giant fans are going to be annoyed. Because this means the number one, if it happens, who knows, if the number one team on both networks will have a former Cowboy quarterback as their analyst.
Yeah. Well. That'll be, I'm sure, something else that we'll be debating during the course of the season.
Absolutely. All right, everybody.
The good news is the commentators have no influence on the game.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. Gave you some nice ammunition on Meadow there at the end of the show. Yes. So you can give him a hard time on Twitter. Get after him. He loves debating people on Twitter. Trust me. It makes his day.
Oh, yes.
It really does.
Oh.
So make sure you go there and check it out.
Thanks
for joining us. Tomorrow, it'll be Paul and Lance once again. I believe you have someone from Missouri lined up already,
and
correct?
And Western Kentucky.
You have somebody from Western Kentucky
we'll
already,
be covering
too.
Both teams. Yeah.
So they got both guys. So if you want to know about Charles Harris, the pass rusher out of Missouri, and Forrest Lamp, the talented guard out of Western Kentucky, make sure you check that out on Giants.com tomorrow on Big Blue Kickoff Live at noon. For Lance Meadow, I'm John Schmelk. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a good one, everybody.